change the way we think about our lives. We don't have a choice anymore.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Haunted by Waters and Like the Dust, to introduce today's show about natural resources and our environment. And a brief update on the School of the Americas Watch, which just ended at Fort Benning, Georgia. And then we'll have a change of pace with a lovely foray into contemporary art of Vietnam with Judith Hughes Day. We begin in Israel with Hannah Schaefer of Zulul Environmental Organization, then we'll move to Iraq, specifically looking at the escalating rise of malformed babies born in Fallujah and the fallout from the burn pits on Balad Air Base used to incinerate all kinds of waste. That's an American military base north of Baghdad. I talked to Hannah Schaefer of Israel's environmental organization Zulul by a Skype telephone recently. I want to welcome Hannah Schaefer, Director of Development at Zulul Environmental Association, a not-for-profit organization committed to protecting and maintaining clean, clear water along Israel's rivers and shorelines. Hannah Schaefer is a graduate of the Arava Institute for Environmental Studies and moved from Portland, Oregon to live in Israel in 2006. Welcome, Hannah Schaefer.
Hi, thank you.
Well, it's great to have you with us today because I think this is a topic that's not covered very much in the United States. And Hannah, Zulul's website states that the organization was founded by a group of concerned citizens alarmed by the ongoing degeneration of Israel's natural water sources and the lack of infrastructure and regulations to safeguard them. So let's begin with the statement, the ongoing degeneration of Israel's natural water resources. What does that mean?
Well, Zulul was started in 1999. This is actually our 10-year anniversary this year. And in the 90s, people's environmental awareness was starting to grow in Israel. But the state of Israel's water resources was really bad. It was in very bad shape. Zulul began our campaigns in Eilat, in the Red Sea, in the Gulf of Eilat, and it was when we came to the Red Sea, we saw that there had been a great change from the way that the coral reefs had looked even 20 years before to the way that they looked then. One of our founders was someone who had grown up and gone diving in the coral reefs as a little boy, and he'd been away from Israel for a great deal of time and came back and went diving and was shocked at the state of things. Because of what he saw, he felt that there was no other option but to try and save the corals before they were gone completely. And so that is how we formed. And initially we worked in the Red Sea, and from there we moved on. From that campaign, we moved on because we realized that it wasn't the only problem in Israel, that there were many issues of water pollution all around the country that needed to be solved.
And what was happening with the Red Sea? What was the main toxic or the main problem down there, pollution problem?
There are a number of issues. At first, it was more easy to solve problems, such as having the city of Eilat develop a better waste management system and having a system in place that meant that there was not sewage or discharge from the sewage treatment plant going into the Red Sea. There was also an issue of the Eilat port, which is a major port for Israel and also has a military base there, and getting under control the oils and all of the different and fuel and things like that that were coming from ships that were going into the sea. And in addition to that, there was a major problem, which was fish farms where thousands of tons of fish were being grown in cages within the Red Sea. And these fish farms were ultimately what were causing the most damage. They would feed fish antibiotics, they would feed them their food, and these fish who were crowded in these cages would then discharge those antibiotics and their food waste and so on and so forth into the sea directly above where corals were growing. And this was causing a huge amount of damage to the reef. And ultimately, that was our biggest fight, was getting the government to make these fish cages leave the Gulf of Eilat and be removed from the area.
Oh, so you succeeded in getting them moved somewhere else?
Yes, we did. And now there are some that are operating in the Mediterranean Sea, where the damage is much less because it's a sea that is much more of an open system, whereas the Gulf of Eilat is it's almost like a lake with a little outlet. And so the actual amount of circulation of the water there is anything that goes into the Gulf has a really big impact, as opposed to if you're in the Mediterranean Sea or the ocean where there is much more movement in the water.
Huh.
And there's also land-based solutions, and there's a lot of fish farms now on land instead.
Zalul must have been quite an eye-opener when it first started. Did you get a lot of resistance?
We did. It was, we've sort of set a reputation for ourselves as being one of the more provocative environmental groups. We haven't been afraid to go out and say that this is not okay and that these polluters should not be doing what they're doing, even when there's political agendas behind their work, or, you know, when they have people who with a great deal of power within the country trying on their side.
Mm-hmm. And I notice on your website, which let me remind our listeners, we're talking to Hannah Schaefer from Zalul Environmental Association. The website is Zalul, Z-A-L-U-L, .org. And on your website, Hannah, you have a wonderful map that highlights all of the real pollution problems along the coast of Israel. And if a user goes there, they can actually click on the different areas and get all sorts of interesting information on the kind of pollution. How did you collect that, and how long did that take?
Well, that information comes from our own research and also from government data. It's a map of pollution that's going directly, this discharge into the Mediterranean Sea. Now we're moving north from the Gulf of Eilat to the Mediterranean Sea. And in Israel, there's what's called the Interministerial Permit Committee. And this permit committee gives companies and factories permits to discharge their waste into the sea, whether it's first going into a river that's a coastal river that then flows into the sea, or directly into a pipeline or that goes to the sea. This committee, for a long time, was not rigid at all in their standards, and essentially any factory that wanted to apply for a permit would fill out the form, pay the fee, and, you know, the next meeting they would approve their permit. Since then, we've gotten very involved in fighting with this committee, and now actually our executive director is the public representative on the committee, so even from within now we're able to make a lot of changes. But that committee is now required to publish the information about who is discharging and what they're discharging and the amount that they're discharging. In addition to them making that information available for us, now there is a new regulation that they have to make that information available to the public, and that every quarter these factories must publish the information in a newspaper or in some sort of a public forum, so that the public is also aware of what they're polluting and they can make their own decisions about whether they want to go to that area or whether they want to support those companies. And that kind of transparency that for a long time was not in existence is now something that we've really pushed for, so that people can know what's going on. And as a result of that, we can see more changes in the state of Israel's water resources.
And are the citizens much more responsive? Are they taking up this challenge and using that information?
I do see a huge change. Even, you know, I've been in Israel since 2006, and I see it change every year. There's much more awareness, and people really are starting to take ownership of their water, of their rivers, of the sea. In a lot of places, actually, we have campaigns now. We've been campaigning in specific rivers around the country. And in some places, people aren't even aware that they have rivers in their area, because these rivers have been so completely neglected for so long that they don't even know that they exist, because they're essentially sewage canals. Who knew that it was a river and before?
Mm.
But once you talk to them and you explain to people that this is a river and this is what it could be like, and we can make this place beautiful, and, you know, someday we can open it up, then you can go kayaking and your kids could go swimming someday if we clean it up properly, you know, then people really say, we want that. That's important to us. We want to, you know, we don't want rivers to be a place in Europe that we go to visit on vacation. We want rivers to be in our own backyard, and we want the sea to be clean, and we want to be able to enjoy this with our families and with our friends. Mm.
Hannah Schaefer, after the project in Eilat was a success and you got the fish farms to move, what was the next big project that you took on and have been successful with?
There's been a number of projects. One I already mentioned, which was our Mediterranean campaign, which we are still involved in. But, you know, in the last 4 years or so, we've really focused heavily on removing land-based sources of pollution going into the Mediterranean Sea and fighting those factories that are polluting into the sea. One of the things that we really focus on is finding solutions that don't necessarily harm factories, finding best available technology, bringing in people from abroad who can go to these factories and can look at what they're doing and their processes and say, you know, if you implement this machine here, not only are you going to save water and you're going to save money, but you're also going to help the environment. And so that's one of our approaches, and I think that's part of why we've been really successful with the Mediterranean Sea and solving some of these pollution problems, is that we do also try to work with businesses as much as we can so that, you know, we aren't hurting our economy and we're building allies instead of enemies. Mm-hmm. Aside from the Mediterranean Sea, we have a big problem, like I mentioned also, of rivers in Israel that have been neglected for a very long time. And that is connected to a great number of issues, but one of them is Israel's lack of water resources and the history of Israel and its water use, and in the sense that many of the rivers that used to flow in Israel, their water sources have about 90% have been taken now to be used for domestic use, for industrial use, for agricultural use, and only 10% of the water that originally flowed in these rivers is now flowing in them. This, you know, becomes a big problem when, in replacing that 90% of water, you allow factories to discharge their wastewater into the rivers. It's like, you know, concentrated orange juice. You know, the less water you have, the stronger the orange juice flavor is. And when it's pollution instead of orange juice, it can really make the river sick. And so that's one of the things that we're working on is really focusing now on finding solutions for these rivers, finding ways to clean up the discharge that's going into them. And also, ultimately, what we'd really like to see is having some of the water that was originally taken from these rivers and return that to nature and return that to the river so that they can live again the way they used to.
Well, let's go back to the statement on the website, the lack of infrastructure and regulations to safeguard them. Has there been an increase now in creating an infrastructure to protect the environment there?
We are seeing changes. You know, many of the problems that we see are actually also with municipal sewage systems. Many of the towns in Israel that are poor towns or don't have as many resources have sewage treatment plants that have, you know, were built 40, you know, 50 years ago and haven't really had that many updates to them since. And because of that, they end up being a big problem in terms of discharging into rivers, discharging into the sea, not having anything that they can do with the extra waste that they have, especially during the winter months when stormwater also goes in and they're inundated with a lot more waste. One of the things that we're working on is getting these cities to get that money, to make that investment into their cities, into these systems, so that problem doesn't exist anymore. And in a lot of cases, it's really a matter of going in and being an outside party and not being the one who's involved in the local politics and going on, stepping up and saying, hey, guys, there's a problem. Let's work on this together. Let's find a solution. And being the person that instigates the search for a solution that can fit for everyone.
And it sounds like that's what happened in the case of the Lachish River. Talk about that. I think that's a good story.
Yeah, it's you know, I think it's one of our biggest successes in the recent years is the story of the Lachish River in Ashdod. This is a perfect example of a river that had been neglected for many years. It was suffering from sewage pollution from the local municipality, from stormwater drainage during the winter that was, you know, all of the junk that was on the streets in the city that was going in, as well as industrial pollution that was coming from a major industrial area just outside the city. So basically you had all of the major players that can cause problems for river involved in the story. We went in, we we decided that, you know, we set a goal. In 3 years, we wanted to have the Lachish River cleaned up. And in 2.5 years, we actually went in. We fought with the mayor, the former mayor now, and we made a huge amount of demonstrations within the city. We went around, had petitions being signed constantly with the residents of the city. One of the things that we implemented that I think was particularly successful was about a year ago, there was a local municipal election, and we went around and as a make the environment something that's a bit more of a priority in people's minds. We did sort of a fake election within, you know, in local areas in the city. We gave people two cards, one that showed a sick and dying river and one that showed a healthy river with birds and fish. And we said, okay, take these, now vote. What is more important? What do you want? Do you want a river that is sick or do you want a river that's healthy? And people, of course, everyone voted for a healthy river, but I think that just that action of learning and thinking about your vote as more than just, you know, do I like this mayor or do I not like this mayor, or you know, am I going to have jobs or this or that, you know, to think about the environment as something that's more important than you may have thought of before, and voting for the environment, I think, had a really strong effect on the community.
And in the end,
a new mayor was elected, and he was very interested in working with us and not fighting with us, because he'd seen that we'd been able to really build a strong support within the community. And together, since then, we've worked together to start really solving these problems. And this summer, much to our happiness, the tests of the river that we've been going and testing the state of the river for many months, and we'd seen a significant drop in pollution, and we decided, along with the city of Ashdod, that it was safe enough to open the river for water recreation. Not for swimming. The standards are still not high enough for swimming, but they are high enough for kayaking, for boating, canoeing, whatever it is that you want to do. And now, you know, this is the second coastal river in Israel that is safe for doing that and can be enjoyed by the local residents.
Mm, congratulations. That's a great story.
Thank you.
We're talking with Hannah Schaefer, Director of Development at Zalul Environmental Association in Israel. Hannah, let's go back to the Mediterranean, because I notice on your website there are days when the beaches around Tel Aviv, for example, are closed because of pollution. So there's still a lot of pollution in the Mediterranean that's still flowing off out of the country.
Yeah, there is. The problem is a lot more common in the winter. We have a lot more issues in the winter. We have seen a drop, I should say, before I go into more details, because there has been a significant drop in the amount of incidents. What happens generally in the winter is that it rains. And, you know, it doesn't rain that often in Israel. And then after months and months of hot summer days and build up all along the streets of exhaust and fumes and oils, when it rains and that goes into the storm system, it does unfortunately go out into the sea, and it does cause a lot of problems during the winter. Other problems that we see, in the last year, there were very specific incidents that caused some major problems. One incident was a sewer pipeline that had broken, and as a result, a bunch of sewage had flowed into the Ayalon River, which flows through Tel Aviv, and then goes into the main river in Tel Aviv, the Yarkon River, and out to the sea. And it was a very large amount of sewage, and flowing into the sea, of course, then makes it unsafe to go to the beach and swim in the water because of the amount of coliforms in the water. But that problem was very specific in the sense that we had to go in and find out who wanted to take responsibility, who was going to take responsibility for this sewage break. And that's the problem that we see the most, is when there is a major problem, who's going to step up and take responsibility? Who's going to solve the problem? Every mayor, every regional council, everyone is trying to find a way to not solve these problems, to not spend the limited amount of money that their local government has. And for us, we have to go in and say, you need to take care of this. We don't care anymore. Who's causing this problem? You have to solve it. Mm-hmm. So in that situation, it took way too much time, and the beaches ended up being closed for about 3 weeks last winter, we ended up having a protest in Tel Aviv that had about 200 participants. It was around the Jewish holiday of Purim, which is a holiday similar to Halloween, in the sense that everyone dresses up in costumes. And we dressed up as pirates and held signs out and you know, with our megaphones yelled to passersby that they were stealing our sea and that people were not taking responsibility. And it got a great amount of media attention, and they didn't and solve the problem. And the beaches, we hope this winter will be safe for the entire season. Hmm.
And let's talk about water in the West Bank. I know there have been a lot of water convoys going out there to deliver water to some of the villages. Do you get involved in that kind of work too?
Unfortunately, at this point, because of the political situations, it's been very difficult for us as an organization to be very involved in issues of water in the West Bank and Gaza. I think that, you know, generally our philosophy has been we're going to solve all the problems that we possibly can within Israel, and as soon as those are all solved, we will go and use our resources to solve these problems in the West Bank as well. Our staff is Israeli-based, and you know, unfortunately, we haven't had the opportunity to really work there.
Uh-huh. Okay. What else would you like our listeners to know about the work that Zalul Environmental Association does?
I think that as an organization, we stand out among among the environmental organizations in Israel in the sense that we are not afraid to say what needs to be said. We do have a track record of strong successes of getting things done. You know, there isn't any sense of being politically correct, of trying to be nice. If there is pollution and it's going into a river, we're going to go solve it. We're not just going to let you get away with something because, you know, you happen to be a nice guy. And I think that in that sense, the Lua has really built ourselves up to be a very strong organization, an organization that people respect, and an organization that people want to work with and not fight against. And I really hope that in the next 10 years of our organization, we're going to be able to make even more changes and really change the face of Israel's water resources.
Well, 10 years is a good inning, so congratulations on that. Tell us how you survive. I know there's a donate now button. Do you get funding? Where do you get funding from? Is it person by person? How does that work?
We're funded by anyone who wants to help us pursue our goal. We've received donations from private donors, from foundations, and also from individual donors and small donations as well. And really, anything that people want to give helps us a lot in pursuing our goal, and it means a lot to us.
That was Hannah Schaefer of Israel's Zalul Environmental Organization. Zalul, as you heard Hannah Schaefer say, elects to work directly on issues of pollution within Israel and raises awareness of water pollution among Israelis. We recently talked to Susan Kopelman of LifeSource, based in Ramallah, who works on issues of water within Palestine, that is Gaza and the West Bank. The focus of LifeSource work is raising awareness of how little water Palestinians receive in comparison to Israelis. I urge you to go to our archive at raisingsandradio.org and download that show. I'll also put a link on Raising Sand Radio website for your convenience. This is FM 90.1 KZSU Stanford University and Raising Sand Radio. I'm Susan Gallimore, bringing you progressive views of topics affecting you, your life, and your communities. Now, we've been airing PSAs for the vigil and direct action at the gates of Fort Benning, Georgia, that just ended yesterday. This is the School of the Americas Watch annual gathering. News is beginning to filter in from that event, and the following brief clip is an interaction with three people and the police that ended up with these people being arrested when their wooden crosses that they were carrying and wanted to set in a fence were deemed too big. The crosses looked about 18 inches or maybe 20 inches high. Just little wooden crosses, and these people were arrested for this travesty of carrying crosses that didn't meet the size standard for blocking the street. Here is a clip of that.
If you want to go in, go in. If you want to stand somewhere, go stand back there. You're blocking our area. So go stand over there, that's fine. I could care less.
I don't think we're blocking anything.
Sir? Over there, or I have no choice but to incarcerate you. Because you've been asked to move politely.
You asked me, sir. You said to move over here. We have to move over here.
trouble with them.
Do you want to go to jail?
Disorder. I don't want to go to jail. No one wants to go to jail.
I'm telling you how not to. Step over there out of the entranceway. All of you out of the entranceway, or I have no choice but to put you in jail. Out of the entranceway. This is the entranceway. Go. Let me explain how this works. If you cooperate with me before the arrest team gets here, you don't go to jail. Ma'am? All you people, if you want to go in. If not, move over that way, out of the way. You're in the way, ma'am. People can't come and
told us we can
clear the entrance.
This side of the yellow or that side of the white.
No, you need to be out of the hole, over on that side of the curb. You're disrupting the street. Come on, ma'am. Over there. You too, ma'am. You too, ma'am. Can you get some of your people to help?
All I can do is tell them what the consequences are. It's their decision. So I'll
go ahead.
I think I've been pretty clear with the consequences.
Let me get everybody to back up.
Okay then, ma'am. You step over here. Everybody this way, go that way. Anybody that doesn't want to be arrested for not following instructions, move back that way. All right? Move back. That includes you. If you're with the legal team, stay with her.
Okay.
Move back, out of the road, clear the roadway. You hear the entire term, roadway. Come on.
The roadway goes like that way for the...
I know. Get off on the side. You're not just going to stand here blocking it.
Curb to curb.
Curb to curb or be moving in or out.
So you want us to cross this?
You don't want to cross that police station. Go over then on the sidewalk.
Step over
on the sidewalk. Ladies and gentlemen, if you are in the roadway, you need to be moving in or out. Does everybody understand that? In or out. In or out of the roadway.
Not entering, move to the side over there with everybody.
Yeah, y'all need to move also. Move to your right. Away from the roadway, sir.
Clear the roadway.
Ma'am,
clear the roadway. Okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, camera folks, out of the roadway too.
Now let's turn to Iraq, where we have two reports. The first concerns the people of Fallujah, where doctors in that war-ravaged enclave are dealing with up to 15 times as many chronic deformities in infants and a spike in early life cancers that may be linked to toxic materials left over from the attacks in May and November of 2004. In a recent report in the UK Guardian, Martin Chulov reports from Fallujah. This is a clip from his piece.
This is Fallujah. The fighting finished 5 years ago, but it is still a lethal place, especially for newborn babies. I've come to visit the Fallujah General Hospital, which I've heard is dealing with a significant increase in serious birth defects. By some estimates, as many as 25% of infants have been born in recent months with serious abnormalities. Jana was born 3 weeks ago. She has a neurotube defect, which means her lower limbs are not working.
She may survive, but some have complication later on. Yes, either keep very big head, there's fluid inside, and there's a defect in this vertebral column. Sometimes it contains brain tissue. This case, the cyst that is protruding here is ruptured. Most of them will have paralysis in the future of lower limbs.
Doctor, how long have you been at this hospital?
3 years.
And in that time you have seen a big increase in the number of congenital birth defects, yes?
Yes. We showed a significant increase in the number of the cases with congenital anomaly and neurotube defects, spinal cord.
Every week, Fallujah Hospital alone is now dealing with around 7 cases of neurotube defects. Babies here are also being born with disturbingly high numbers of tumours and mutations that staff here had never seen before the 2003 invasion. The hospital is a rare success story a newly built facility that offers as close as possible in Iraq to best practice healthcare for Fallujah's children. But the hospital is simply being overrun by the desperate parents of newborn. This baby has a congenital heart problem and a neurotube defect. If she has any chance of using her lower limbs or strengthening her weakened heart, she must be treated by specialists outside of Iraq. Her parents have been trying to take her to India. Dr. Abdul Ghani, an obstetrician, browses through a chronicle of case studies she has compiled of babies born with defects during the previous 3 weeks. There are 37 on her makeshift register. Some are unlikely to make it. The rest will need intensive specialist care for the rest of their lives.
Six finger.
First time I see this.
Abnormal head, abnormal ears, and congenital heart disease, and she have a cleft palate. Mm. No palate. Mm.
The one factor that sets Fallujah apart from the rest of Iraq is that heavy munitions were used extensively here during two large battles in 2004. Whatever is maiming the babies of Fallujah, doctors here now acknowledge they can't deal with the aftermath by themselves. As well as now asking for international help, they are now also calling for an international investigation into the causes.
That was the UK Guardian's Martin Chuloff reporting from Fallujah. Now, he writes in the UK Guardian article, neurologists and obstetricians in the city interviewed by the Guardian say the rise in birth defects, which include a baby born with two heads, babies with multiple tumors, and others with nervous system problems, are unprecedented and at present unexplainable. A group of Iraqi and British officials, including the former Iraqi Minister for Women's Affairs, Dr. Nawal Majid al-Samari, and the British doctors David Halpern and Chris Burns-Cox, have petitioned the United Nations General Assembly to ask that an independent committee fully investigate the defects and help clean up toxic materials left over after decades of war, including the 6 years since Saddam Hussein was ousted. The rise in frequency is stark, from two admissions a fortnight a year ago to two a day now. Quote, most are in the head and spinal cord, but there are also many deficiencies in lower limbs, said David Halpern. There is also a very marked increase in the number of children less than 2 years old with brain tumors and multiple tumors. After several years of speculation and anecdotal evidence, a picture of a highly disturbing phenomenon in one of Iraq's most battered areas has now taken shape. Previously, all miscarried babies, including those with birth defects or infants who were not given ongoing care, were not listed as abnormal cases. The Guardian asked a pediatrician, Samira Abdul Ghani, to keep precise records over a 3-week period. Her records reveal that 37 babies born with anomalies, many of them neural tube defects, were born during that period at Fallujah General Hospital alone. Dr. Bassam Allah, the head of the hospital's children's ward, urged international experts to take soil samples across Fallujah and for scientists to mount an investigation into the causes of so many ailments, most of which, he said, have been acquired by mothers before or during pregnancy. Other health officials are also starting to focus on possible reasons, chief among them potential chemical or radiation poisonings. Abnormal clusters of infant tumors have also been repeatedly cited in Basra and Najaf, areas that have in the past also been intense battle zones where modern munitions have been heavily used. Statistics on infant tumors are not considered as reliable as new data about nervous system anomalies, which are usually evidenced immediately after birth. Dr. Abdul Wahid Salah, a neurosurgeon, said, quote, with neurotube defects, their heads are often larger than normal. They can have deficiencies in hearts and eyes, and their lower limbs are often listless. There has been no orderly registration here in the period after the war, and we have suffered from that. But in relation to the rise in tumors, I can say with certainty that we have noticed a sharp rise in malignancy of the blood, and this is not a congenital anomaly. This is an acquired disease. This is KZSU FM 90.1 at Stanford University and Raising Sand Radio. I'm Susan Gallimore, bringing you again progressive views and topics affecting you, your life, and your communities. Now we're going to stay in Iraq and turn to Balad Air Base, about 68 kilometers north of Baghdad and about 40 miles east of Fallujah. Allied Air Base is one of the largest bases at 25 square kilometers and with about 25,000 U.S. military personnel and several thousand contractors. In March 2004, General John Abizaid, then commander of the U.S. Central Command, told the House Armed Services Committee that, quote, "We are making Balad Airfield our primary hub in the region, and the idea of doing that is because we need to have Balad International Airport revert to civilian control." Now, according to Paul Bowers of the Post and Courier, in June 2008, Balad had three cleaning burning incinerators handling about 120 tons of waste each day. There's also a burn pit that takes in 147 tons of waste per day, and this includes styrofoam, unexploded ordnance, petroleum products, plastics, rubbers, dining facility trash, paint and solvents, and medical waste that, according to those performing the burns, include amputated limbs. According to several documents and witnesses, the base had no incinerators for medical waste, so everything from used needles to amputated limbs was tossed into the burn pit. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Darren Curtis, former bioenvironmental flight commander for Joint Base Balad, wrote in a memo dated December 20, 2006 that, quote, "In my professional opinion, there is an acute health hazard for individuals. It is amazing that the burn pit has been able to operate without restrictions over the past few years. There is also the possibility for chronic health hazards associated with the smoke." He said contaminants, many highly poisonous, that troops may have been exposed to include benzene, an aircraft fuel known to cause leukemia, arsenic, dichlorofluoromethane, or freon, carbon monoxide, ethylbenzene, formaldehyde, hydrogen cyanide, nitrogen dioxide, sulfuric acid, and xylene. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel James Elliott, former chief of aeromedical services for the 332nd Air Expeditionary Wing, was deployed to Balad at the time and co-signed Curtis's memo. Elliott wrote, "In my professional opinion, the known carcinogens and respiratory sensitizers released into the atmosphere by the burn pit present both an acute and chronic health hazard to our troops and the local population." Now, an incinerator for medical waste was not installed at Balad until April 2005, Harvey said. In addition, there's an Iraqi-run recycling center near the burn pit where Iraqis sought out recyclables that previously had been tossed into the burn pit, such as roughly 90,000 aluminum cans produced daily by the base, and the Iraqis sell these on the local market. In early 2007, the Air Force Institute for Operational Health conducted a joint assessment of the burn pit, and a draft executive summary dated December 2007 showed dioxin levels at 51 times acceptable levels, particulate exposure at 50 times acceptable levels, volatile compounds at 2 times acceptable levels, and cancer risk from exposure to dioxin at 2 times acceptable levels for people at Balad for a year, and at 8 times acceptable levels for people at the base for more than a year. Meanwhile, defense officials continue to say burn pits do not pose serious health hazards. In a statement dated August 6, the Defense Department's Office of Force Health Protection and Readiness had this to say, quote, "While exposure to burn pit smoke may cause temporary coughing and redness or stinging of the eyes, extensive environmental monitoring indicates that smoke exposure, not interfering with breathing or requiring medical treatment at the time of exposure, usually do not cause any lasting health effects or medical follow-up." Now, meantime, three Charleston area servicemen filed a class action lawsuit against Kellogg, Brown & Root, the company that the Department of Defense hires to run day-to-day services, including waste disposal at many U.S. military bases. The lawsuit alleges that KBR burned hazardous waste on various U.S. military bases, including not only human corpses and biohazardous medical supplies, but also, as we heard earlier, styrofoam tires, lithium batteries, asbestos, insulation, paint, items containing pesticides, and latrine waste. KBR Director of Communications Heather Brown said in an official statement that the company did not operate the Balad burn pit. Brown did not comment on activities at other bases where KBR is alleged to hold waste removal contracts. She said, Brown said, "It should also be noted that any burn pit operated in Iraq or Afghanistan is done pursuant to Army guidelines and regulations."
And we're going to move over from the environment to Vietnam, where recently an art exhibit, Meet Vietnam, came to San Francisco. This introduces the Socialist Republic of Vietnam's business, educational, and cultural developments in an effort to increase our mutual understanding in San Francisco and California. As part of the event, Judith Hughes Day curated the exhibition of Vietnamese contemporary fine art called Tradition and Change, Vietnamese Art Today, which includes work by 15 of Vietnam's most respected artists. And it's my great pleasure today to welcome Judith Hughes Day to our show. Welcome, Judith.
Thank you very much.
It was such a wonderful surprise to walk into this art exhibit and see the range of work that is available. And I was fascinated with the influence. I understand there's quite a French influence in art.
There is.
Start off with how you came to be involved in this kind of art and go from there.
All right. I've always been interested in Asian art. And happily for me, my husband and I have lived in Korea, Japan, and Hong Kong. And it's when we went to Hong Kong that I was introduced to Vietnamese art. And the reason was that I had just finished a second master's degree at Columbia in East Asian Studies with a concentration of Japanese art. And when we were transferred to Hong Kong, I realized that there would not be Japanese art available to me there. But fortunately for me, a friend and neighbor from Tokyo, who is Chinese and was living in Hong Kong at the time, told me that she wanted to start a gallery of Vietnamese art, and she wanted me to be her partner. And that was in 1992. Our gallery in Hong Kong opened in 1993. And despite warnings from Chinese friends that no one would buy or be interested in Vietnamese art, we became quite successful. Mm. And at that time, there really were not many, if any, galleries in Vietnam. And I think our work helped encourage many to open later.
And why do you think that there was a sense that Vietnamese art wouldn't be very interesting to a larger audience?
I think that the Chinese, as any group, were really focused on their own art. They felt that probably no one would be terribly interested in art from another Asian country. But to the contrary, Vietnamese art, with the European influence that you mentioned before, I think was of great interest, particularly to Western people, but certainly not exclusively.
Well, let's talk about that influence. How did that come about?
Well, as the French were the colonial power rulers in Vietnam for many years, they set up an educational system. And in 1925, a group of young French artists, one of whom is reportedly a classmate of Matisse, Victor Tardieu, they began the École des Beaux-Arts de l'Indochine in Hanoi. And prior to this, there had been other colleges, but they were for a shorter period of time in Saigon and in Hue. And with the Hanoi College of Fine Arts, it was really a five-year art program which introduced young aspiring artists to a whole range of new perspectives and mediums and things that they'd never imagined possible. And there was an explosion of creativity.
And it's very difficult to talk about art in this medium of sound. So I'm going to refer our listeners to your website, which is artnet.com/judithday.html. And I'm actually holding the catalog in my hand, and it's fascinating because there's a sort of African Cubist style. There's what I would think of as even sort of an Edward Hopper. There's a piece called Sunday Morning. There's some sort of Rothko-looking pieces. I mean, it's very interesting artwork.
Yes. It's actually, for some time, the artists were really relegated to working for the government, and there was not much opportunity for private showings of art. It was really not a commercial thing. And in 1985, there was an economic development called Doi Moi, which opened all kinds of new markets and included an opportunity for artists to show their work publicly, and many, many different styles came out. Some are very much influenced by indigenous Vietnamese art forms. Others are European influenced. It gave artists who'd had the experience of using with Western mediums like oil and acrylic an opportunity to really experiment and do all kinds of new things. And the work is quite remarkable, I think.
And as I understand from what I read at the exhibition, a lot of the art became, let's say, soaked into very small villages. But the influence was quite great, wasn't it?
Yes. During, particularly, you're speaking of like during the war period?
Right, yeah.
Yes. Vietnam has seen many wars, not just the one that we're the most familiar with, but they had the French, and several of the older artists actually fought against the French to drive them out, even though they'd attended art school with French teachers. And others, of course, fought against the Japanese who were in Vietnam. And during the what they call the American War, the artists were employed by the government and actually went to live in the villages and worked with the people, drew the people, drew the villages using whatever mediums were possible, ballpoint pen, pencil, crayon, very simple things. And they became close to the soldiers, doing portraits of soldiers for the soldiers' families, or that sort of thing. They were not necessarily painting battles. They were painting Vietnamese life as it existed at that time.
Mm-hmm. And we've done actually a number of shows, but usually on Vietnam. But usually they have to do with the war. And I was coming into this show in San Francisco, and this happens quite frequently when there is something that comes out of Vietnam, current-day Vietnam. There's often a set of people outside protesting, and the same was true this time. There was a large group of people protesting. And what was that about, do you think?
Well, it's quite understandable, actually. There were many Vietnamese that left Vietnam following or during the war, and it's not a happy thing to leave your homeland, even though I think most of these people are very well settled here and have had very happy and successful lives. They still feel that their home country belongs partially to them, and it does, but also their new country belongs to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel, I think, a sadness and a resentment towards the people that are in their country, what they consider their country now.
Mm-hmm. And this exhibit was actually part of a delegation that came over. And the delegation was about economic well-being?
And education and culture. The presentation was really to acquaint the people of the Bay Area and California in general with what is happening in Vietnam today. And there are sister city relationships between some of the cities and San Francisco. I think most Asians feel a closeness with the U.S., particularly California. And they wanted to have this event to show what is going on in Vietnam now.
Let me remind our listeners that we're talking with Judith Hughes Day about a recent exhibit, an art exhibit in San Francisco, Meet Vietnam, also Tradition and Change, Vietnamese Art Today. And you can see, I really urge listeners to go to the website, which is artnet.com/judithday.html. Judith, when you look for work, what do you look for? Again, there's a real variety of work here. There's woodcuts, oil paintings, some ink drawings. What do you look for?
Well, I look for, I think, what I believe everyone should look for when they're looking at art. I look for things that really mean something to me, that I find visually interesting and beautiful, and that's really what I look for. But for this particular exhibition, I wanted to show the great variety of work and the inclusion of some really indigenous ideas and mediums, like the woodblock print, like paintings on silk, things that have been done for centuries in Vietnam. And also contrasting with that, the new mediums that were introduced by their French teachers and the different ways that they've approached those mediums, some in what we would consider very traditional ways, some very definitely not.
Yeah, this piece called Mountain Stream, the ink on paper, is exquisite.
Yes, it's beautiful. This is a young woman artist, exclusively paints with ink on paper, but she paints in a very contemporary manner, mm-hmm. I think. And she spent, I think it's 2 or 3 months in Vermont at the Vermont Studio Center several years ago on a fellowship, and she chose to go in the winter. So some of her paintings look like they may have snow in them, and indeed they do, which is a very happy circumstance when you have ink on paper. It really shows it off. But she paints trees, forests, streams, rivers, all manner of landscapes, and I think they're quite beautiful. They're more immediate. Chinese painting is generally very remote, in the distance sort of views of mountains and things.
Right.
Her paintings are much more close up.
And they're actually large, too. This particular piece is 54 by 27.
Yes,
that's a large
is.
Piece. So what else would you like our listeners to know about the Vietnamese art?
Well, I've been back in the United States for 11 years now, and I have been showing in various places, showing the work. I live in New York. But I would encourage people, if there are traveling exhibitions, and there have been some, if they have an opportunity to go and have a look at the work, I think they would be quite surprised and pleased with it.
And are you going to have another show again coming up?
Yes, I'm actually participating in an art fair in Miami in early December, which will be, there are probably 20 art fairs simultaneously in Miami at this time, and I'm going to be participating in one of them. I'm hoping, as a result of Meet Vietnam, that I will be doing some exhibitions, possibly with universities, in the Bay Area in the near future. I have an exhibition coming up in New York, which will be a one-person exhibition of a young artist who basically works with lacquer, but because I wouldn't accept lacquer because of a fear of that it might crack, devised a very complicated method of painting on paper, and his work, both lacquer and on paper, is quite remarkable.
Hmm. And that will be early next year?
That will be in the spring in New York.
Uh-huh. And again, the the website is artnet.com/judithday.html. People can get in touch with you there via email, but I'll give you the email address here now, although it might not be easy for people to remember. JHD, Judith Hughes Day, JHD, artasia@aol.com. jhdartasia@aol.com or artnet.com/judithday.html. It's been lovely to have you with us, Judith.
Thank you very much, Susan.
And that is our show for the week. As usual, all views and opinions are those of the hosts and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Contact me directly at susan@raisingsandradio.org or visit our website, raisingsandradio.org, to download any of our previous shows. And let's go out with Haunted by Waters and their full piece, Like the Dust.